Welcome. We're going to do Connect This. This is exciting. This is a show. I'm going to start off with the gratitude version. And right as we started, I see a Wi-Fi indicator, which suggests I'm perhaps a little bit not coming through great. Makes me super paranoid and nervous.
You are fuzzy faced.
All right. Fuzzy faced with a fuzzy face. I don't know what that's all about. We have a special guest throughout the entire show today. We're going to have another fuzzy faced special guest for a part of the show. But I was just going to start off before I introduce folks with a giant thank you, because Rye is producing this show on his 20th day in a row of working. We did Tribal Broadband Bootcamp, Matt Rantanen, myself, and bunch of other people in Southern California this week to set it up. Ryan and I went out there, worked the whole weekend and a little bit before to prep fiber deployment build. We'll talk about that with Matt some. But it wouldn't be successful without Rye and Jess and Jordan on my team having done so much of the work and all the things that I get credit for. So just want to start off by thanking them, thanking Travis. We asked Travis if he could help us find some fiber to be donated, and he got us 1,700 feet. I'd asked him for 1,500 feet. AFL came through, and Travis, we buried every last inch of it. You were right to ask for more.
Okay, good. It showed up.
Made sure we had the right slack loops and all that. So great. Thanks for that. It's pretty exciting. So I think I'll share a video here when Matt gets here, one of our brief promo videos. But let's talk about who's in the room. We got Travis Carter from USI Fiber in Minneapolis. Welcome.
Good day, Mr. Mitchell. Welcome back. I see your fiber to the home internet is working amazing today. So
I don't know if I have had some local issues. I think that's all. I've shut all that down. I don't know if CenturyLink's upset with the terabytes I've been putting across it and is letting me down or what. Next time I'm going to run a direct link, run an Ethernet cord directly to the main hub, so I'm not going through my extra switches, which I really need to troubleshoot. Anyway, Travis, great to see you. And Kim McKinley, back again. Great to see you. Welcome.
I'm here to provide all the awkward jokes. You're welcome.
Also, a recap of Connected America. Is that the name of it in Dallas?
It is the name of the conference I just got back from last night. It was a good conference. It's I think they said there were 1,500 people and a lot of good conversations. And it's, I think what I gathered from Connected America is it's really the wild, wild west out there right now. And it's going to be an interesting few years, to say the least.
Cool. And then you ran into some folks that made a rather boastful claim that they watch us.
So just because YouTube only says 5 people watch us, other people say that the people who spoke to me said a lot of people appreciate our commentary and the lightheartedness that we provide to a very serious topic. So we did get a lot of kudos and people who say they watch. I know we're all shocked, but some people might actually like this show.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Is Ruben there?
I did not see Ruben. I don't know if he's there. But I bet Ruben's watching now.
Apparently, the StreamYard doesn't work in Safari. I just got a text from our short-term guest today, Matt. And so we'll see if he makes it on or not, if he can find a workaround. But Doug Dawson with a festive shirt for the day. Welcome back, Doug.
Well, as usual, I'm not the man in black like the rest of the panel. So today is a leprechaun shirt because, you know, it is. So, yes, very festive.
Excellent. And then joining us for the day, Brian Snyder, former CEO of Lit Communities, a strong advocate for public-private partnerships, a guy who's been building networks for a long time. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's awesome to be with this great group, first of all. But I'm excited to talk about broadband, but I'm also excited to talk with Doug more about the dead after the show's over. I think we'll have some good conversations.
Yeah, maybe we should just leave the camera running for that. I don't know. might be our most successful episode.
I'm just upset that he doesn't want to talk to me and Travis. Okay, fine. We'll keep going. Keep proceeding.
So we got Matt in the green room. We'll bring him out in a second. But I did want to note, Kim, you're going to be going to Broadband Communities in Houston. I just had to pull out from it, I think, unfortunately. But my colleagues, Ryan and Sean, will both be there. Should be a great show again this year.
It's going to be, who doesn't like to go to Houston in May? So we're preparing a lot of deodorant and a lot of broadband chatter. And I have officially made broadband a verb. So I'm going to go broadbanding in Houston in a few months.
Awesome. I hear you're accepting texts late into the night now too. So,
okay. You get one LinkedIn request late at night. It's a little awkward. And let's not talk about that, Chris. Let's keep going.
So we've had some requests to talk about chicken wings, but we're going to ignore that. And we're going to talk about the tribal priority window. So we'll bring Matt Rantanen in. And Matt has been involved in advocating for this, along with a lot of our friends. We're an idea that was first done with low power FM, I think. But let me have Matt introduce himself. I'll just say that Matt's one of my closest friends, but I hope you won't hold that against him. He still has some views worth listening to. And Matt, why don't you take it away and talk a little bit about how we got a tribal priority window, the fast version.
The fast version of tribal priority window. All right. So I was actually the chairman of the board of Native Public Media at the time, and we were fighting for opportunities for radio stations to get, or for tribes to get more radio station access. There was a windows opening and closing to apply for FM radio, full power license. And, you know, tribes could sort of get their ducks in a row to try to hit those windows, but there hadn't been one in a while. And there were some tribes that wanted to get a station going. There was currently funding. So Native Nations Broadband Task Force, National Congress of American Indians, and a few others, Native Public Media, all the ones that sort of I've been in and around with myself, Jeffrey Blackwell, Morris Taylor, and others, have been pushing really hard to figure out a way to get tribes licenses. So they developed the language for tribal priority window. It opened up the window all the time for tribes to be able to apply. If there was competition in the space over the tribal reservation land, the tribe would win that competition in serving their own communities, and it would waive the licensing fees. A brilliant step forward for tribes. I think we over doubled the number of tribal radio stations in the process. Fast forward to, you know, hey, we need more spectrum to be able to do wireless broadband. The unlicensed space is so cluttered and there's interference. And, you know, we really need to unlock some spectrum for tribes to use for community broadband. And FCC decided to recall the EBS spectrum, educational broadcast spectrum space, misuse, you know, not used, et cetera. So in advocating for access to that spectrum, we were able to grab the language from the FM about tribal priority window and apply that to 2.5 gigahertz, which allowed tribes an opt-in process to be a license holder, a full FCC license holder, based on where the three channels that were being, or the three sections of that spectrum that were being allowed to be licensed were available. Now, we got stuck with a rural tribal definition from the chairman at the time of the FCC, which was horrible because that excluded tribes within 25 miles of a population of 50,000 or greater. And those tribes don't have any services, even though they're near population. So that kind of wasn't cool. And then, let's see, then we got into the situation where the FCC was like, okay, we predict there's going to be 11 or 12 applications for this, because there's 11 tribal telcos and there was another one trying to come on board. There were over 500 applications for licenses, and I think they've allocated over 400 licenses to, I think, 325 tribal entities. And, you know, the reality is it's a great tool in the toolbox to build broadband. 2.5 is right in the sweet spot of doing point-to-point and point-to-multipoint LTE stuff. But what a lot of people don't know is that a FCC license is extremely valuable as a bankable asset, because tribes can rarely have collateral to put up against loans when they're building their broadband because they're on sovereign land. A bank cannot repo sovereign land. So they can't collateralize their land to be able to borrow money. So they can collateralize an FCC license that has an assigned value or a projected value. So that becomes, you know, two tools in the toolbox for moving forward with broadband. That's the short version, Chris.
Thanks. I appreciate it. We had a couple of requests from folks to talk about what's happening with the deadlines that tribes have to hit. So all those tribes that have licenses, obviously you and I know of many that are putting them to very good use. What deadlines do they have to meet in order to continue having that license available to them?
So when they first released it, they released a two-year sort of midterm build hitting 80% of their population, and then a four-year 100% population sort of encapsulated in the build, which is really uncool because everybody else on the planet gets 4 years and 8 years to do that. So, you know, once again, we advocate for tribal participation, you know, at fair and equal opportunities to others. And there was a public notice extending those deadlines in 2022 as the first two-year deadline was coming up, and extended them to the traditional 4 years, 8 years, just like everybody else has. I don't know why you'd penalize tribes because they're new license holders. So anyway, status quo now, 4 and 8. That four-year mark is coming up right around the end of this year, depending on when the license was given. Now, some of them were given all in one big chunk kind of right away within about a 30-day period. And then there were some stragglers. And then there are some that are complicated cases where there's some overlap that they're fighting out right now, still have not been allocated that. So the timeline starts, the four-year timeline starts from when you actually receive. So that was probably sometime in 2020, 2021. And then you have a four-year timeline to build out to 80% of your population. The reality is, if I can find the number real quick, that's one link per 25,000 people. So it's a really low lift to hit your license mark for tribes. A lot of tribes don't have 25,000 people. So the vast majority of
tribes do not have 25,000 people.
I mean, Navajo, Cherokee, and a few others, you know, are in the hundreds of thousands, but very few others are. So we do have a couple of California tribes that are getting close to that. So, you know, realistically, they're going to hit their final goal if they hit their four-year goal in making a meaningful link between, you know, two tribal buildings that support the functionality of their community, provide access to folks, whether that be, you know, a learning center, a library, a tribal office, et cetera. And so, you know, they're well on their way to, you know, to meeting their license requirements. And I think, Chris, you and I have helped, I'm going to guess, maybe 20 or 30 tribes get along that path. So,
well, I want to see if the panel has any questions about the tribal priority license, but I also just want to note that this is up in the air right now for another chunk of spectrum, and that for anyone who's worked in Indian country, it is, I think, really frustrating to know just how much spectrum is out there and could be put to good use that is not being used right now through spectrum sharing as well. And so, you know, we talk a lot about fiber, but I think a lot of our discussion about fiber is talking about more populated areas. If we had access to better spectrum, we could deliver really high quality services in Indian country because so much of it is not being used out there right now. Travis, did you want to jump in?
I was just curious, how big a is that an 80 megahertz block you're going after, Matt?
There were three chunks. Are you talking about the next fight or the previous fight?
Well, I'm just curious. So 2.5, I have two questions. How big is the spectrum and how widely available is the equipment? Because with now 6 gigahertz becoming a reality, and with 320 or even larger spectrums, is it even worth the fight?
Right. So with the 2.5 gigahertz gear, there is quite a bit of equipment to choose from, and several manufacturers, you know, it being close to 2.4, you know, they were able to shift some gears and do some engineering and put some products out right away. Albeit some of those products kind of fell on their face and had to do some R&D in the field to fix it. There are quite a few products to choose from right now. the size of the license depends on where you're at. There were three chunks of spectrum within that space, depending on where you're at, and they were overlapping. Hopefully you got all three, because then you could actually do something meaningful. And I think that was in the 80 megahertz space, you know, amount. But then if you lost one of those, two of them were fairly large, one of them is fairly small. So if you lost one of the two of the larger ones, you know, you were really going to be limiting yourself to what you could pull off of this. Like I said, it's really cool in the toolbox. It's not all the tools in the toolbox.
But why spend all the time, effort, and energy when 6 gigahertz available now?
Let's get you out to Hoopa Valley at some point.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, because
no, I'm curious. Check out the trees.
Yeah, we become our own worst enemies in interference, and geography is a reality. So okay. Hoopa's got some of the biggest trees on the planet. And they do not like wireless. They actually are a very good shield for wireless. So
fair enough.
Technology. Yep. Yeah, it's technology and just another tool. I mean, I can speak for Tribal Digital Village Network in Southern California. Our first hop from our head end of our network, our first tower, anything goes up, something has to come down. There is no more spectrum left available to us to put on that tower.
Any other questions? Matt's on, I wanted to ask him about the Tribal Broadband boot camps as well. So, Doug, Kim, Brian?
I just wanted to mention, he just pointed out how easy it is for license holders to preserve their spectrum when they do win these, because commercial guys will put that one damn link up and then claim to have the stuff for the next 10 years. And, you know, and they're really speculators. They're not intending to deploy it. So I'm glad that works for the tribes, but it's a ridiculous rule for some of these speculators. I wish they were a little tighter on it.
Yeah. It's a low bar for warehousing, isn't it?
Very, very low bar. Yes.
Yeah. And what was that you mentioned, Chris? Tribal Broadband Bootcamp. What's that?
Yeah. And how's Waskawiwin related? Again, the short version, Matt.
Short version. All right. So Tribal Broadband Bootcamp. That's Chris Mitchell and myself creating a wonderful opportunity for a bunch of tribes and a bunch of broadband builders to get together and talk about, you know, cover to cover, what is broadband, from, you know, how to deploy it, to how to design it, to how to manage it, and you know, how to find funding and just, you know, how to have resources and such. And I'll get a little bit more into that. Waskawiwin is developed. It's a nonprofit pending to be the parent of Tribal Broadband Bootcamp. We have had fiscal sponsors in the past, and they have been very generous with their time and energy for a certain period of time, but alignment with their mission doesn't necessarily align with our mission, and there's restrictions, and we lose money off the top to overhead, and you know, it just is time that there is an organization that is specifically dedicated to the boot camps and things like the boot camps. So we started waskawiwin.org, and waskawiwin means the act of being active, or the act of being in motion, which we feel like so many people talk about the problem rather than just start doing the solutions. We kind of are the doing the solutions folks. And that is a Cree word from the Alberta region of Canada, where Maya people are from. So were you going to go into that video, Chris?
Yeah. So here's one of the short videos we just did from this week.
If that was Matt, that was some excitement pulling fiber.
Well, does anyone else notice the obvious issue here?
What is it, Travis? What is it?
We don't see Chris Mitchell doing any work at all. So,
Chris is a supervisor. That's what we like to call Chris.
Travis, you've known me long enough to be surprised by that.
Was he doing the feasibility study while you were working?
Oh, he just threw the gauntlet, Chris. He just threw the gauntlet down at you.
Travis, honestly, we're a half an hour from town. He was looking for the closest wings.
Okay, is that what he was doing? Okay, because I didn't see him at all in there. So okay.
I'm pretty sure.
I was just, you know, I was just asking what everyone was thinking. So
yeah, so that is a short sizzle reel of the prep work that went into the last Tribal Broadband Bootcamp, our 12th event. So TBB 11, if you will, because we started at zero like the dorks we are. You know, it was an amazing event. We put I trenched 800 feet of trench. We put two conduits in all those trenches. We pulled 1,700 feet of fiber. Thanks, Travis, for aligning us with that opportunity. And you know, it was really amazing. A lot of people got dirty and sweaty pulling fiber and trying to figure out, like, wow, we had no clue what this would look like, and we had trenches all over the place open and opportunities for people to get their hands on, pulling on mule tape, shooting, you know, Home Depot bags through the conduit to get their string through, all kinds of different stuff. And we actually started to configure the fiber network, and then we actually got a wireless link set up on a tower that was set 4 weeks ago. And it was a pretty amazing experience. The Tribal Broadband boot camps have touched, you know, over 65 tribes and probably 300 plus folks at this time on our 12th event. You know, obviously we're trying to get, you know, the tribal sphere to better understand what they're tackling when they're going to take on broadband and, you know, access to resources and everything that we've known for the last, you know, I've known for the last 23 years. However, the coolest byproduct of this entire event and why it is so important is now we have 300 plus people that are building broadband in Indian communities that have each other to rely on. There is this network of people that is so strong and so powerful for them to be asked questions, vet vendors, you know, talk about products, you know, talk about solutions, beg, borrow, and steal from each other. You know, happily, because they, you know, live in the same region and they never talked about things, but now they're sharing tower climbers and they're sharing, you know, spools of conduit and they're, you know, they're sharing spools of
fiber. Yeah, and resources. Let me jump in also to say that ANZA Electric Cooperative was really helpful in getting out there to do the work. We had Matt was welding there a platform for an aerial demonstration. So we showed how to lash fiber. They showed how to lash fiber on these two poles that Matt rigged up. And also Calix put in a bunch of time to get us an E7 platform and some of their different products to show off as well, and then worked with us to configure them over the weekend. So, I mean, they really stepped up as well. They've been great partners.
Merit too. Merit really, I mean, Merit did some sweat equity in this one. Nick and Charlotte and Bob were full blast for 4 or 5 days straight. It was pretty
impressive. Yeah, without them, we're not doing any of this. So any last questions? We can't spend the whole day on this, unfortunately.
I think we should talk about the Home Depot bag sometime, because isn't that amazing that that is the super high tech element of our industry?
And that is the high bar tool too, because if you switch to any other bag, it doesn't work.
Oh yeah, Home Depot bag. Did you guys use a vacuum cleaner too? Then
Not just that, but also we already, you know, we did a bunch of that work ahead of time, but we left a conduit or two open, and specifically, and we're like, if you really want to do this, we could do it. And like everyone, that's all they wanted to do.
They wanted to watch that go through that tube and then they all
wanted to pull the fiber. Yeah.
It was hilarious.
Matt gave us some real hard work too. We got a real sense of it. Actually, there's a different photo that, Rye, if you have a sec, we can throw it in a little bit later of Matt pulling, where he found some rock and had to do an S turn in the conduit. And Travis, it turned out we were in 3/4-inch conduit rather than 1-inch conduit, and so that made it a bit tricky at times and a lot more work.
Yeah, I weigh 260 and I'm 6'4". And, you know, I played soccer for 28 years. I've skied my whole life and I'm, you know, fairly athletic, and it took everything I had to break that fiber loose to get it to move while I was pulling it through that conduit. Absolutely everything I had. It was amazing.
Where was Chris while that was happening?
I think wings again.
Okay.
I was taking photos, man. It was hard work.
There I am.
Yeah, but who was paying for the wings if you weren't there, Travis?
I raised funding for that.
Did you know that Travis actually donates to a wing fund for when he's not available?
Yeah, Matt, the pro move on that is don't do it by yourself. Get four or five people to help.
Yeah, no doubt.
Like the old tug of war, right? Because
sadly, we did not have four or five people. We had Chris.
Well, I mean, while we're talking real. There was a point where I put down my champagne and I tried to help out. And Rye was pulling a harder section and with the mule tape. And the mule tape is great, even though it was like had some lube on it. And then you hit the actual jacket of the fiber. And that if that has any lube on it, there's nothing to hold on to anymore.
Oh, okay.
There's no friction on the actual, if you get lube on the actual fiber jacket.
Indeed.
So that made it hard.
I think the video speaks volumes. One, that we don't know where Chris is at. And then two, the fact that you're seeing something be done. And I know this segue into another conversation we're going to have. But instead of getting data and reports, you're actually seeing it firsthand. And I think that showing that video can speak volumes to what others, not, you know, tribes as well, but other communities should really focus in on. Kudos to those for how y'all handling it. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. And you know, we wouldn't be doing it without, I mean, all the stuff I've learned from people on this show, from instructors we've worked with, Esther, Spencer, now Cody, Spaggy, so many of the folks from Indian Country that have been doing this. You know, folks from Cheyenne River Sioux Telephone were doing a lot of the splicing, Mario and Jared. And that's one of the things that I feel like has been amazing is how much has been happening with lots of people contributing what they know. And you can, I mean, we could, I feel like we could build anything with just a lot, with a lot of people kicking in a little bit of knowledge.
Very determined crew.
Hey guys, we have an important business to take care of. Ruben tuned in after we had already given him a shout out.
Ruben turned in when I was talking about lube on my hands. That's why he was confused.
Oh, here's Chris working. Yeah. There he is with a feasibility study.
No, if you could see the back of my neck, you'd know I didn't have an umbrella that was that big, unfortunately.
Yeah. A little sunburn.
So, Matt, thank you. We'll have you back again to talk about any one of the many other things you're working on that you're able to talk about. And but I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, everyone. Good to see you.
All right, so this gets to one of the things that we wanted to talk about with Brian here, and that is feasibility studies. We've been made a couple of jokes about it. So I do feel like, first of all, I should say that Brian is going to be on Community Broadband Bits next week on Tuesday, and we talk more about this. But Brian, you're coming into a show with four people who have expressed a lot of skepticism about the way feasibility studies are used. And so I'm curious if you want to kick off the discussion by just noting why you say it's always feasible.
So basically, Chris, what you just did is saying, we're all going to attack you, Brian. So give us your best.
I'm happy to find ways to attack him if you'd like.
I don't think you are. So, but bring it on. I'm ready. from that standpoint. So, my background, when I was getting more into the municipal fiber space, it was a wake-up call to me when I was looking at it from a, we worked with large carriers to analyze markets on how to build out. And when I started looking into what people were calling feasibility studies, I thought they were an absolute joke from that side. And like, I even looked up the definition of feasible at the time too, because it was, I was curious as to even why they were calling them feasibility studies, because it was the way I looked at it when I analyzed some of those reports, it was like, I could Google search this and print it out and give it to a community. Broadband's good. Cool. Okay. Now what, how am I going to do something with it was the problem.
People would like to pay less.
Yes. Oh my gosh, the way consultants ultimately were looking at the industry, because our game wasn't to consult and then try to get more consultant contracts. And I think that's the way certain folks were handling communities, especially back before COVID. And this is when we were talking about this and really engaging in it. And just so I can read it, the definition of feasible as an adjective, it's possible to do easily or conveniently. First of all, building a fiber network or any network is not easy from that side. But then the other piece of it is likely probable. Like, yes, you can go build these networks, whether it be a wireless network, an open access network, a fiber to the home network. You could ultimately get it done, but it involves a business model and a business plan and knowing all of those like levers from that side. And I think that's what we really focused on early on. And that's why I came up with like the hashtag, it's always feasible, because it is. You just have to really find the right business model and work with the community the right way. And not really try to give them a cookie cutter report about how broadband's good. Give them a business plan.
It's not always feasible in the way they think it's feasible. I think that's what you're kind of trying to say, right? You're saying that there's creative ways to get there, but I think where people get confused is you can't have a home of 500 and think that you can build your own network and operate it. That's not feasible. But if you can do a collaboration of cities or communities around there, it might be, right? It's just a different way to approach it.
And that's what I would say, Kim. First of all, hashtag not all consultants, but I would say if you got 500 homes you're responsible for, like I think borrowing money and going out and building those 500 homes and trying to recreate Comcast's model on the miniature is not the way to do it, mm-hmm. but there may be a path. And I think that's what the question is. And so it's not one of saying, you know, can we or cannot we be mini Comcast, which is, I think, what too many feasibility studies become, but rather here is a path toward your goal. And that may be 20 years and maybe 10 years or something like that. Doug, you're leaning forward.
Well, one thing is I know some guys who built 50-mile networks out the back of their pickup truck and they have 100 customers and they're doing fine. They don't have any bank loans. You know, they're serving their neighbors. They went, look, nobody's coming here. So everything is feasible if you start with the bottom resources. And I completely agree with Brian. I mean, I do feasibility studies, but ours are not really feasibility studies. They're business plans. Here's how you pay for it. Here's how much it actually costs to build it. You know, can that be made to work? Yes. 90% of the consultants put out these, you know, feel good pieces, which are pretty much pieces of garbage. So
it's operationalizing feasibility studies, right? That's what it really is operationalizing feasibility studies. And a lot of them just stop at feasibility studies and you're like, great. But a lot of people, don't a lot of states have that requirement in their, in some of their past funding that's what I've heard as of late, that some states had that requirement that they needed a feasibility study.
Well, and there's a lot of states who've actually paid for a whole bunch of those bad studies.
Or they have a P3 partner, right? I think too.
I won't name the state, but there's a state who paid for every single county to do what they called a feasibility study that did nothing more than list the prices of broadband that were existing in each county and stuff like that. It's like, really?
How much did those they get paid for those feasibility studies for that market research?
Well, the guy that won the project for most of those was probably getting $20,000 to $30,000 for each one of them. Yeah, but the state paid for it. Yeah.
Jeff Glavinsky went off. He and I argued on a panel a long time ago. He was on the panel. I was in the audience doing that annoying thing people in the audience sometimes do. And my point was that, like, you can call it something else, although, like, there is some level of research a community needs. And I think that's important, is that, like, all of us are, I think, really afraid of communities that jump into this without studying it. The question is do you know the right questions to ask? And do you have a consultant or someone that is going to answer those questions in a way that will actually help you or not?
Yeah, I agree. I think the community has to buy in as much as the right consultant, let's say. And if you have those two working together, it's really cool what you can come up with. I think that's what's neat, to where, like what Kim was mentioning about the 500 home village or the tribal nation that we were just talking about too, just as much as you're having issues in New Orleans, Louisiana, building out fiber networks. Mm-hmm. Like this is everywhere where it's an issue, but it can be handled up front, to me, a lot better. And it is kind of sad that I think it took the pandemic to accelerate broadband. It took the pandemic to create this kind of create the right narrative, would be to say, but really to push things through. But like Chris, you and I were at meetings a couple weeks ago. We're talking about now, how are we going to get to that last 20% that still we don't feel like is probably going to be served by everything that's happening right now. And that's where we can sit there and still say, we can still get to you. We just have to figure out a damn plan to get it done. So anyway, I get frustrated about the whole feasibility side of things. I think you can make it happen. You just got to work the right way.
And it's so funny that you're still topping this conversation, because I'm seeing a lot of communities who don't even want to do feasibility studies anymore. They already know. So I think it's just where the temperature is in different communities. Some people are like, why would I pay for this? I already know that my city or community needs this connectivity. So I think the market's changing a little bit, but I think that there's a lot of consultants who are out there pushing this as well, because they say that communities need this.
I'll say this as we're drawing this part of the show, I mean, this topic to a close, is that part of the feasibility study historically had been to force reluctant council members on the decision-making board, I think, to take a position on it in some ways and to say, like, here are all the reasons why something needs to be done. And there is value in that as well. Travis, is there anything that you want to jump in aside from making fun of me, which is also allowed?
No, you know, I think a financial feasibility is the biggest thing, especially given today's borrowing environment is so much different than it had been historically. So, you know, can you realistically operate a network in your area, give a high quality service, and even have a chance to compete with the incumbent? You know, because it's going to take a lot of time. I mean, you saw just doing that little 1500 feet you did, what it took to construct it. Well, then you got to operate it.
We didn't have to pull any permits.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. But I will say this.
I'm writing that down. I'm pretty sure that's in violation of the local codes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was going to say this one last thing, and I think that there is a place for feasibility studies, which I would be the person who wouldn't say this. It does give some communities political cover. It gives political cover that they did this for their residents and why they did it if somebody comes to knocking a little bit.
Yeah, and like what you said earlier, like some folks, like communities have to do it, and just based on requirements to check the box, you know, from that side. And sucks, I think, ultimately at the end of the day, because I also agree that you're seeing so many communities bypass it, which I think is freaking awesome, because they're actually putting that money that they would pay for a feasibility study to, like, even, like I said, that boot camp that you just saw on video, that money would go better to seeing that done, so you actually know what it looks like and it's real to you, than just getting a report. But I also agree with Travis, I agree with Doug, like the big pieces of it is the money. How are you ultimately going to tie this in together? That at the end of the day, how are you going to get the capital stack to go get this done? And the community's either going to have to buy in and rely on a partner, or the community is going to have to say, you know, no one else is doing it, we got to do it. Or that, unfortunately, that community's potentially going to get left behind.
And Kim, that's a financial business plan, and that's not the typical feasibility study.
Correct. Okay.
So, yes. And I noticed when we were down in Florida, Kim, you know, like private equity and stuff isn't just throwing money after feasibility studies anymore. You actually, you got to be able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. They want the expertise at the end of the day. I think that's what you're seeing across the industry right now, is that a lot of money has been poured into a lot of projects because everybody thought this was easy. And everybody on this call, this podcast, knows it's not easy. So more of these private equity are looking for the right partners and or partnerships who can actually pull some of building these networks off.
All right. So we have a couple other topics. FCC stuff, Federal Communications Commission, 120. Yay, we did it. We did it. Yay.
Well, this is the last podcast because we've now solved all of our problems.
Yep. It's great. Good talk.
So yeah, I'm not gonna sit here and tolerate y'all being snarky. I'm just gonna say that, like, there's two good things that are coming out of this. One is 120 is a better ratio of upload to download, and we're moving toward gigabit by 500, which is still a better ratio of recognizing the importance of producers as well as consumers. So, you know, I'm better late than never. I'm not gonna attack the FCC for waiting so long, but it did.
You just
what? What? What?
I couldn't do it. I tried. It just popped out.
I thought, guys, I was watching really closely because this is a mic drop moment where the podcast shuts off. The mic was going to come from the wall and just come down and be like, we're done. But no, we're still here.
How about the irony, though, of this whole of Chris with his 1 meg by 500K upload link he has right now touting the new FCC standard, right?
Well, yeah, but know, Travis, again, like this is what the ISPs would say. I actually think Lumen has a good link to my house. I've screwed it up inside my house. So I mean, who knows, though? Maybe it's not my fault. It probably is.
Oh, Ruben, my man. Yeah, yesterday's speeds tomorrow. Welcome to, yeah. How embarrassing would it be to go out and try to market? Kim, you go out and try to sell 100 by 20 to some people.
And tell them that they don't need much bandwidth. That's the strategy of, excuse me, you might want 10 gig over 10 gig symmetrical that we offer, but let me tell you what you really need is 120. Yeah,
that's, and sadly, I think WISPs are great, but that's how they market. You don't really need.
That's so exactly this is the perfect example. Doug had a post, which was a very good post, unlike normal, gaming the bead map.
Unlike normal? Wow.
I thought I'd sneak that in. I mean, one of the top 20 blogs on broadband internet access. I'll give him that for sure. March 5th, 2024, gaming the bead maps. Excellent post. Per usual, Doug. Interesting thread on the comments in which the second person is like, hell yeah, we game it. We're lying straight up about the services we offer. although it is somewhat moot because they're not being considered seriously because they use unlicensed service. And if I had to put money down, they are probably doing a good job of delivering a high quality service for what they offer. But it was entertaining that they were like, yeah, we're offering it. And we're lying about what we do. And that's because we deliver what people need. And the part that gets me about that is the whole, we know what people need, right? Like the electric company being like, you know what? You're going to have 80 amps and like it. You're not getting any more than that because no one needs more than that. And we're deciding for you. That's the part that really just bugs me about this is when people make this, they're like, they're going to decide for everyone else what an appropriate amount is. So who else is up?
Well, let's talk about the history of that. Remember when Google Fiber announced gigabit, every single cable company CEO came out and said, people do not need fast speeds. What the hell is this company even talking about? And they were so big brotherly about that. We're giving you all you need. At the time, they were giving you 60 by 3. And they were telling the whole world that that's all anybody ever needed. So, yeah, that's a very big brotherly sort of approach for sure. So.
And in the background, some of those same companies were preparing to build fiber because of what Google Fiber was doing too. So they were advertising, yes, marketing completely differently when they had completely different plans in the background. And I think it was one of those, yes, oh crap moments. We got to deliver something better than a POTS line.
Now, at the bottom of that thread, which is interesting, is a comment from another WISP who says, or a consultant, while some WISP may provide bad data, our company does exhaustive PE certified analysis, says they have 300 WISP per filing and that they will defend their data. They're not just putting circles on the map. And so I'll say also not all WISPs, hashtag not all WISPs. Certainly, we've been very clear about this. People never appreciate that, I feel like. But there's certainly a number of bad actors, more than I think these people want to admit. But here we have him saying he wants us to put up or shut up the, you know, people who are lying to the FCC. And, you know, I don't really get that. I mean, like the FCC, they literally could fine ISPs, but I think we all know that they won't actually do anything about it.
Well, we're going to see some putting up or shutting up in the various state broadband map challenges because people are challenging these giant WISP circles. So it doesn't mean that they're going to win because the NTIA came out with ridiculous challenge rules. It's almost impossible to meet, but people are going to challenge it. So,
yeah, so I don't know if anyone else had any reactions to that, but
I want to make another bet. When do we think it's going to go to gig symmetrical? What year do we think that the FCC is going to get gig symmetrical?
That's sooner than you think. Upgrade. Yeah.
Oh, I think I would say 2026, 2027. Here's my reasoning.
No way.
We're gonna see the cable companies, especially in response to how much they've been losing to the wireless companies, accelerate the DOCSIS 4 symmetrical. They're gonna be offering gigabit, you know, like up and down. And I think as they get more and more aggressive, they'll be pushing the FCC to set a higher bar to try to disadvantage the wireless people. So I see it happening in 2026, 2027.
I'm actually reverse of what you just said. I think because of the cable industry, it's going to be like in that year, it might get up to like 235 because 35 is the most they can freaking do.
No, that's the thing. DOCSIS 4. Like Charter is $100 per household away from having faster upload speeds, is what they tell their investors, right?
Charter also said that now they're delaying their DOCSIS 4 for at least 2 years.
Excellent. And I will see if that changes, is my point.
Mobile has full 5G coverage too, Chris.
Okay, guys, let's not be shocked. Chris is the optimist of this group. We already know that. So, he's that guy. He's that guy of, like, you have friends like that. There's always that one guy. Chris is that our one guy.
I'm always that one guy for every friend group I'm in.
I'm lining up for all 26 or 27 bets. I'm taking it all.
So when do anyone else want to put a date down, put their credibility on the line?
I would say 20. I'm going 2030.
And 2030, they're not going to go to gigabit. It'll be something less.
But what was the bet? Gig symmetrical?
Mm-hmm. That's what Kim asked.
Oh, I'll be dead.
I don't think it'll ever happen.
Yeah.
Right. I don't either.
2037 at the earliest.
If this show's still going on, Chris, you deserve a damn award if we get to that point. That's what I think we should commit to, right?
We'll
a
bet you a award for not chicken wings.
Not chicken wings.
Yeah. You get a whole steak. So
you'll get a gig.
It'll be synthetic, but it'll taste really good.
But here's the thing. Does it really even matter what the FCC defines broadband as?
Well, that's a great question, because you know what? That announcement this week said anyone who's got a speed less than that is not broadband anymore. They can't say my 5010 is broadband. It's not.
Okay, but here's the question. I'll double down on that. Travis is right. Nobody even defines it as broadband. Like, who cares? More people know what internet access is than broadband anyway.
So, do you? Right. I'm looking at all of our marketing material here. Do you even use the word broadband anymore?
Mm-hmm. When I'm talking to you guys, but not in like any marketing materials. No,
internet, number one internet, fiber internet. I don't, broadband's like an old, you know, that's an old fashioned.
You know, I started that saying broadband again when I said I used to work in the internet, and that got a little a little crazy of what people thought you did if you said you work on the internet.
Like Zoolander, so, I'm in the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Fellas, another example of a question we never get asked. So what do you do for a living?
Well, nowadays, if you work in it, you're probably trying to be an influencer.
Go ahead, Kim.
Who cares what they define it as?
Well, I mean, it does have implications for what solutions are available for to get money, which I think, you know, has some importance. But Travis, I do think, you know, in many of the discussions that you and I have about the role of the government, I do think that, like, if we were to get rid of the FCC, things would move along well enough for the next few years. And then I think we start to, like, really have problems over time. I think there's a lot of things they do that sort of keep things within the rails. And I think they could be better rails. But I think the definition will help out in some ways over time, in ways that are hard to predict in terms of the long-term investments and signposts and things like that. I don't know. It's hard for me to justify it. You can tell as I'm just speaking right now.
Wait a minute. What did Ajit Pai do at the FCC?
Well, I was just going to say, is this the time we talk about the game-changing FCC legislation that happened? For the 1200 megahertz block of spectrum in the 6 gigahertz band, that will make all these speeds actually plausible for WISPs and other wireless providers. Yes,
I just wanted to ask you, Travis, who is your favorite FCC commissioner?
Well, of course, it's Ajit Pai.
Name a third one.
Name a second.
Name a second one. I don't. I don't know.
Nailed. You just got nailed by Mitchell.
GG Sohn. Yeah.
No, Travis, I was waiting.
In the real world, does this even matter, Kim? Does it matter what they say? No,
but I think that's where the industry needs to change in general. Let's stop defining what the FCC is as broadband, and let's the consumer decide what they need as a speed. I think that is where the market needs to change. The consumer did.
In 2019, right before COVID, 54% of people were buying speeds less than 100 megabits. Today, it's 10%. They have decided. The public's already moved on.
As we exit this topic, Travis, you missed an opportunity because I know you don't track the dates as well and who is commissioner, but the second thing that I always give Pi credit for, the first is 6 gigahertz. The second is the tribal priority window, although he narrowed it to only be available to rural tribes, screwing Tulsa, among others. It was his leadership, I think, that led to, I should say his leadership responded to great advocacy in the community to have a tribal priority window, and it set a great precedent, another great precedent. So thank you, Chairman Pi. Travis?
Real quick, who was the chairman during the Woodrow Wilson administration, Mr. Mitchell?
That's a trick question. There was no FCC yet at that
point. There was no FCC. Yes, exactly.
Brian, Chris always talks about the Woodrow Wilson era and how taxes were 187% back then, and there was a better time.
The taxes weren't that high under Wilson. They became higher in World War II following the Depression.
Yeah,
that was a good try to trick him up there. But I've got actually a question back to Travis. Since the states are dictating where BEAD funding is going, will this teach us a little bit about what would happen without a less involved FCC from that side too?
It will teach us, but no one else is going to pay attention. Yeah,
that's a good point.
You know, I guess my issue always has been, Brian, with BEAD is that it really is, it's going to do some good, but it isn't going to do very much for the people that really need it. And that's in the urban centers. And, you know, like Chris sent me an email yesterday, there's an area here in Minneapolis that could really use some help. And unless somebody private steps up and does it, it's not going to happen. But the $4 million lake home up on Gull Lake in northern Minnesota is going to have multiple gigabit symmetrical fiber internet thanks to BEAD.
Well, that's true, Travis. But there are also people who are living up there. I mean, there's a veteran of the Navy living in Le Sueur who cannot get access to her mental health appointments or other things from the VA because of that. And hopefully she'll get served. Now, unfortunately, she's in an area that may be left behind because of the stupid technicalities around the mapping and everything else. But there are people who desperately need service out there who hopefully will be served by this, as well as the Senta millionaires in Gull Lake.
Yeah.
So Oprah, I think, is going to get service from the California California Rescue Plan funds, looks like.
She will.
So bulk billing before we run
deservedly,
out of time.
Deservedly so. She's Oprah. Come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oprah deserves internet too. 100 by, or I'm sorry, I was reading the notes wrong. Bulk billing. The FCC is trying to deal with something that we've long been concerned with, which is some of the games that primarily the bigger ISPs play to try to lock competition out of apartment buildings and things like that. And so we want to talk a little bit about that. And I always have deep concerns about this because a flat out ban on bulk billing could actually make it harder to have good solutions for low income apartment buildings. So Doug, what's up?
And it will, because they did two things. The first thing they did was they said, if you're a tenant and your landlord makes you take either broadband or cable TV or telephone, you can say no. And so all that's going to do is if 10% of the people in an apartment drop out, he's going to raise the rate 10% to everybody else. I mean, that doesn't really fix anything. It just means 10% of the people won't have anything. They're not going to get an alternative. The second thing they said they're going to do is, and this sounds like a sprinkle of magic dust, they're going to make it cheaper for other ISPs to come in and compete in that situation. I can't imagine. Travis, is there any way the FCC could make it cheaper for you to get into an MDU?
No, and the part I didn't understand about the order is, does it mean that the owner of the property has to work with other providers, or just that they can't sign a bulk deal with a provider?
They can sign Bok deal. It just allows tenants to drop out of the Bok deal. It doesn't stop the landlord from doing
anything. It doesn't solve the problem we have.
But now take the low income. Let's just say that they are offering really good stuff for $10 a month. If half the tenants say I can't afford $10 a month, it probably doesn't work anymore.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's still going to kill it. Yeah.
How many ISPs are really out there overbuilding MDUs, you know, in major metro areas?
Oh, I think more and more. I mean, WebPass is back at it. I have showed Rye in San Diego. I got an ad for WebPass when I was there, which is a rooftop to rooftop thing, kind of like Monkey Brains and NetBlazer and some of the others. I feel like that's been a decent business model, but you're not seeing that, Travis?
Well, it's a good model in downtown high rises and beyond that. And university dorms is a big market, but that's about it.
But it isn't going to make a significant, I mean, numbers. If you look at a metro area for the number of MDU units to the numbers that are qualified to actually have rooftop to rooftop, and then you got to factor in probably the half hour to an hour of outage per year due to weather, it's just a tough business to get into. You got to run fiber into those buildings, and you got to be into them.
80 or 90% of MDUs are 8 units and less. That's not going to fix any of them.
So one of the things that I think we have to deal with is that there's a very real issue in that I think correctly, the state and federal governments are loath to interfere with property owners' decisions about how to run their property, right?
It's not just them. Every time they've tried to do that, the Supreme Court told them they couldn't. So there is a barrier there that they can't overcome.
So. Right. And so that's what I'm talking about. I mean, we have a respect for property rights, and sometimes that's a giant benefit, and sometimes it's a pain in the butt. Certainly with easements and things like that, the way our system works. One of the things we've seen though is that San Francisco and Oakland, because of the way California law is, they have decided that they have the right, and they've been successful so far in asserting that a building owner does have to work with an ISP to allow them to install. And that does seem to be making a difference. It's not 100% of the time, but if it solves 80 to 90% of the issues, then that's a huge win. What we need there is state and local solutions to address this. Well, no one has the cricket sound ready.
I mean, it's doing MDUs is hitting the ground hard, working with the property owners, getting entrance agreements, and I just don't see how any of that's going to change. You know, some of this, and if the government tries to force these people, they're not going to work very well with you. If you come in waving your, you have to let me in. You just really got to work with them.
It's about relationships and building trust, and forcing anybody to do anything is never going to work. At the end of the day, it's just never going to work. No matter what any of the federal government says, what the state government says, people are going to find a way around it because they don't want to just be told what to do on this front of what they have to do with their business model.
But I will say,
I'm disappointed. I thought we could force people to watch this show. Damn it.
Yeah.
Well, someone has this. The numbers that I'm seeing on the screen right now are unlike anything we've seen before. So I don't know if Kim's fan club from the conferences has shown up, but we're doing well today.
It's all Brian.
It's Brian. Good talk.
We've lost three since I said that. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, the investment community, though, is very, very pro bulk MDU right now.
So Juan asked the question, Travis, and I think the answer here is no. Bulk billing that big of a deal with telcos. Like AT&T has a rooftop-to-rooftop program, I think.
They do.
And it's not been
very successful, yeah.
What are you guys seeing on the cell phone and a box internet companies? Because we're getting customers coming back from Verizon in waves right now. You know, they went off thinking they could save $20 and they're onboarding. The reality is it's just not consistent enough for modern internet.
And that's what it is. It's not consistent. Yeah. The speeds go up and down crazy during the day. I would have been able to see a whole last year's Ookla in a lot of places. And I can see one, a given customer goes 400, 200, 10, 80. I mean, their speeds bounce like crazy. And the first time they hit 10, they go, this is a piece of crap, and they get rid of it.
Yeah. This is the latest trend. I mean, we always have trends that are coming up and coming in and going out. Like, this is just the latest trend. And fiber is the stable force. everybody keeps coming back to these more reliable internet connections. So yeah, I think Travis, you are seeing some people who are buying into it, but I think they're jumping off pretty fast because they need, people don't realize what they need until they need it, right? They just want their internet to work.
No, it's a great product in rural areas where they're competing against hotspots, but that's so, those folks are coming back. Yeah.
So. Brian, you looked specifically at going into markets to try to provide a service that would connect to the people who've been left behind. How are you planning to deal with apartment buildings and things like that when you are modeling it out?
Well, from the ISP side, they're incredibly difficult to build in when you're bringing fiber in, and like you are looking for bulk deals when you're going into that perspective. Like if you're an ISP, and like Doug was saying, like for most of the MDUs in the cities that we were working with, we're not dealing with skyscrapers where there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of units that we can go make money off of. And when there's only 10 to 20 units, let's say, you pretty much need to be the only ISP in there to make it make financial sense. And from that side, I would then look, if we were going in and competing, a wireless play into the building would make more sense because of cost efficiencies and competing from that play. I think the MDU ruling, like what ultimately came out, it's still not going to change anything. ISPs are still focused on bulk deals. Going to be focused on that because of the in, especially older MDUs too. In building, just building it is hard as crap and costly.
Kim?
No, I was just going to say the exact same thing. And it's, and then we keep focusing on the ISP, but this, the developers are a huge aspect into this MDU space that nobody really seems to talk about, because a lot of developers are getting a, constant revenue stream by these bulk deals that they make. So these guys are tied in with each other really tightly, the MDUs and the developers. And you have to break both of those apart before you really can solve this problem.
So you mentioned, Kim, about the need to like build the coalitions, build rapport. Travis mentioned that as well, building those relationships. One of the things that I've said would help in talking to different folks is educating the landlords in terms of their rights. Because we've had discussions. I mean, this is all me as I'm sipping cocktails under my umbrella on the beach, talking on the phone with people. You know, they'll be like, we have these landlords, but they say they like to work with us, but they can't because they have the contract with Comcast. Mm-hmm. My understanding is a lot of those are unenforceable, or they don't mean what they say they'd mean. And I've strongly encourage people to work with an attorney general, where you have an attorney like that's working with you, draft some language, a page or two, that then the attorney general would want to sign, that basically says, hey, landlord, these are your rights in general. This is what you can do in federal law. You don't have to worry about a contract in this way, because it's not enforceable if you think that you can't let a second provider in or something like that. Because, you know, if someone says, well, I talked to Chris Mitchell and they said that, you know, that law, that you can let a person in. But if the attorney general has a letter you can hand out that says you can let other providers in under these circumstances and things like that, I feel like that could really help to break an impasse.
A decade ago, Seattle actually undertook a landlord training program, and that did make a difference there.
Now, Travis.
Or you do it the way we do it, which is skip that building, do the building next door, provide a high quality service, and then market to the people that don't have it. Then they'll go to their landlord and say, we want it, and work it that way. Here's what doesn't work. I have a letter from the government that says I can come and work with you.
Right, but that's not what I was saying, Travis. I mean, that's
like, go pound sand, or I'm going to call the attorney general and snitch on you. That doesn't work in the real world.
No, that's not. I think you missed what I was saying, but that's hilarious.
That's actually what you said.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that when you have a landlord that says, I would like to work with you, except I cannot because I signed a Comcast deal, then that's where you can say to them, actually, you didn't sign that deal that you think you signed. Brian?
I have a proposition for a future show, though. We should have Travis go to an MDU with a form like that, and let's just see what happens.
Oh my God, we'll never work with him again. Yeah,
I'll work the camera. As long as I don't have to do anything hard, I can do that.
Yeah, but I'm going to go back to Chris's point here. Let's go back to Chris's point. Let's talk to a guy who whatever, an ISP developer, and go, you could go to the attorney general to try to figure out this contract with Comcast that you might get out of. Like, no offense, but who the hell is going through that much effort when you can just wait it out for a year?
Specifically, nonprofit groups that are funded to try to figure out how to connect low-income residents are like, we are talking to apartment building owners in Oakland and San Francisco and in Baltimore. These are conversations I've really had. And they're like, we're getting turned away because they think they don't have the right because of a contract they signed with Comcast. And I'm saying, if they can talk to that landowner, that landlord, to say, these are your rights, with an actual letter from the attorney general, and the landlord can say, oh, actually, I don't have an exclusive with Comcast. They've been lying to me, because this is what happens, is that they get one signature from the landlord, and then they're like, you're not allowed to ever let anyone else in the building, even though that's not what the contract says. But the landlord's not a lawyer either.
2024 has changed, guys. 2024 has changed. Chris, positive Chris is back. We had negative Chris for a while, but positive Chris is back. We're good to have you back, Christopher Mitchell.
I had no idea this was a let's jump on Chris show, or I would have been a lot
more. I mean, the reality is what we've seen is these agreements with the incumbents are marketing agreements, not access agreements, and they get confused. But I'm going to tell you the reality of the world. So, okay, so you work through that and you wire up the building. If they're in a bulk arrangement with the incumbent, your uptake is going to be very poor. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very poor. So you really, if they have a bulk deal, you really have to look at it and determine if it even makes sense to do it, or go do the building next door.
That's exactly what it is. It's you're operationalizing the first part of the conversation we had. Does it even make sense for you to go into a building when you're going to get 5% take? And like Brian said, the cost and the hassle is huge. So why the hell would you do it?
And then if Chris, you and I've gone through this for 10 years, if you try to throw on a inexpensive product into the mix to try to help folks get internet, now your financial model completely falls apart.
Yeah.
So it is a tough situation. And then if you don't own the infrastructure in the street, let's say you're buying circuits from the local, you know, telco, now your financial model's dead in the water. So it's a tough one. You know, Kim, you don't even do MDUs, do you guys? Or are you?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on the ISP. It depends if they want it at the curb or they want us to do the in the unit installs. Okay. But I think you're seeing an uprise of, I think it was bulk, a lot more bulk you were seeing even 3 years ago. You're starting to see more fiber per unit, but I still think it's a very split model that you're seeing from these ISPs and how they want to deliver it to these MDUs.
And I would just tell people, be really careful how drunk you get on the rooftop to rooftop too. Because that's a whole, in areas with a lot of weather, that you're going to have issues.
Travis, I'm just not going to listen to a guy that had an outage over 10 years. You had one outage at 3 a.m. I saw the thread about it, and
I got a one-star review off it, and I'm still upset. So, yeah.
Brian?
Well, how dare you have an outage?
That's crazy. But going back to what Chris said and then what Doug said was successful in Seattle, does it turn more into a tenant educational program but also a residential educational program with them? And it's like, in a sense, like it's a MDU boot camp to teach them like they're not the only provider that can be in here and things like that too. Now I don't want to, now you're going the tendency of tenants against the owners too, so that can be fun and entertaining.
You do realize though that 80 or 90% of landlords are at people in their big corporations.
Oh yeah.
We figured out Chris's new venture, MDU boot camp. Thank you, Brian. After tribal boot camp is now MDU boot camp.
If you need anyone else to supervise the teaching of other people.
Brian, we have noticed, though, that the tenants do have a lot more pressure out and can get things done with landlords than you can just trying to talk to the leasing agents. So
all right, we got to...
If you have a good group of tenants, they can actually get things done. It's really helpful.
So as we are wrapping up, I wanted to just throw something out there and see if anyone has a last comment, which is that I had heard that there's an effort in New York in the legislature to try to limit where state funds are spent for the municipal improvement program. That's not the name of it, but the great program the state has developed to improve service. They're going to limit it only to underserved areas. And my reaction to that is just always, I feel like it's one of those things that people just say when they have no idea what they're talking about. Because if we actually knew where the unserved areas were or underserved areas, then we could have that argument. But fundamentally, what that means is just we're going to have more restrictions and just rule out a bunch of areas that are murky based on the games that are played by the ISPs rather than making investments where local leaders have deemed it necessary. So I just want to, it just always frustrates me when people are like, oh, well, we should do it only in this area where there's no data set that will actually show us where that is. Doug, I thought you were going to jump in.
I have no closing comments on that.
So the response is, if you hear these arguments, is always like, great, well, who's deciding where the underserved areas are? Because the FCC sure is not. Kim, well, I'm loving it right now, but I can't hear you. I'm assuming you're just saying, hey.
I was going to say, let's all just sit around and have a spicy margarita, and like then we can figure it out with those FCC maps. We can probably make that happen, right?
Yes, Fonz, I think we can do that.
That's funny. You actually made a joke, Mr. Mitchell. That's impressive.
I'm so proud of myself.
Did you see the show in that jacket?
No, I did not. I went in put mid-show.
I'm really curious. Where are you going after this?
You just don't know, Brian. We can't disclose this on Connect This. I have too big a fan base to make that happen.
She's going to let her hair down and get on the Harley. I think we'll be back in 2 weeks. People should let me know. I feel like a Friday thing is working. And, I think a lot of people enjoy on a Friday pretending to work while half listening to us. So I think we could keep it up.
And does anyone have Ruben's contact info? We should just let him know so he's not late again. He is our fan. So.
Yes. Well, so. Yeah.
Our main guy has to be here, right?
I mean, I think we actually did a not terrible job of promoting this one ahead of time. And I'll try and do that again here. So people have more than 24 or 36 hours notice we're going to be getting together. But I'm just going to keep looking for Fridays as best we can. This has been a really fun show. Brian, thank you for stopping by and hanging out.
Yes, thanks for allowing me to be a part of the group and all five listeners on YouTube. Based on what Kim said, listening in. Mm-hmm. Are we up to six now?
So we didn't talk at all about lit communities. And I will say we didn't, I think, spill the tea is what the little ones say about all that. But we did talk about it in the Community Broadband Bits show. So if people are interested, a little bit of that discussion, but a lot more of the interesting stuff you've done, that'll be next week's Community Broadband Bits.
Yeah, that'll be next week. Chris and I were late one night doing that recording, so we had some fun there, I think, and just losing where we were talking. So hopefully y'all can follow along as well. Good luck.
Travis, Kim, Doug, thank you all so much. A great thanks to Rye, who got up yesterday morning at 3:30 Pacific time with me to get his butt back in the Midwest. Thank you all. This has been one of the better episodes of Connect This.